Please help us help me welcome our speaker tonight, Tom C. from the Nazareth Group.
My name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me down. I love this setup. The setup is awesome. And I'm grateful to be here. I'm sober today only because of God's grace and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for a sponsor that directed me to the big book and the 12 steps and put my hand in God's hand. And I've been able to walk this walk with people, a lot of people I know here and my family. And I'm grateful that I have what I do today. I'm grateful I was able to drive down here, man. There'll still be days when I'm like driving without a breathalyzer or without the police behind me. And I'm like, wow, man, I can't believe I'm doing this. You know, like how good it feels. And my sobriety date is August 4th, 2015. My sponsor is Matt. And my home group is the Nazareth Group. We meet on Monday and Thursday. I recognize some people that have come up there. August 4th isn't my first sobriety date. My first time I came to AA was in 1989. And I've had multiple periods of sobriety. I was sober for 2 years, over 2 years, over 11 years. And so, I mean, I've been coming around AA a long time. I've come to meetings drunk, I've come to meetings, left meetings, got drunk, drank during meetings, thought I had it all together, had everything together. On paper, my life was unbelievable. And what AA gave me, the things that I accumulated over all the years, and then to relapse and lose everything, and then to do it again and again, and just not be able to get sober again, was awful. So I know what it's like if you're coming back, or if you're still sober and you're restless, irritable, and discontented, because that's how I was for a long time and just didn't know it. Like I was always uncomfortable, uneasy, never satisfied, nothing was ever good enough. And just that restlessness, man, like that. Just not knowing what to do with myself or where to go. Being uncomfortable all the time. And I'm not like that today, but I know what it looks like because I'm very in tune with AA. I'm very in tune with the 12 steps. I'm in conscious contact with my higher power throughout the day. And I start my day like that. So when I'm not right, I immediately know it. Like that sixth sense kicks in, that intuition. And I'm able to kind of rein myself back in, or I can make a phone call or utilize different things to get me out of that moment. But usually it's like, damn, God, I need you like right now. Like I got to get my shit together. Excuse me. I got to get my stuff together right now because I know what it's like when I'm not right. And not being right cost a lot of people in my life dearly. And I was one of the people that came into AA early on and felt like I really just hurted myself. And you know, I left, you know, women and children in my wake. And you know, thank God I have what I do today. But just to kind of to give you a little bit of my experience, and most of it is being sober and then relapsing. Because the first time I got sober was 16 years old. And I needed AA as much then as I do now or at any other time. I was just as much an alcoholic then as I am now. But I remember early on, I got sober in the Bronx. I'm from the Bronx, New York. And the meetings I would go to, basically in the late 80s, early 90s, you got a lot of just don't drink and go to meetings. Just go to meetings and don't drink. And that works for a lot of people. But for someone like me that constantly relapses and constantly goes to meetings and constantly drinks, it gets demoralizing. And we have a term called, you know, a pitiful and comprehensible demoralization. What that is that when you've been sober for a long time and you relapse, and you know everything, or you think you know everything, and you just can't get sober again. That's that feeling that I've carried for a long time. And I think a lot of it, looking back and seeing how I lived, like a key ingredient of my sobriety is humility and being humble. And that's, I think it says in a step book, that's a like a willingness or a desire to seek and God, do God's will. I may mess up the pages or the wording or the paragraphs, but I don't mess up the message, because it's this message that I'm standing here sober today, and only through God's grace. I had my first drink probably I was around 10 years old. Everyone in my neighborhood drank. I think I might even been a little younger than that. My older brother drank, his friends drank. I came from a broken home. I had an alcoholic father, mother with mental illness. A lot of people come from dysfunctional families. I came from a dysfunctional neighborhood. The whole neighborhood was off the hook. Everyone drank. Their parents drank. They all stumbled home drunk, or at least that's how it seemed to me. So when I picked up the first drink, it was natural to me. Like there was no, it just seemed right. It seemed to fit. And, you know, I don't know that the way I grew up made me alcoholic, but it certainly didn't help. I know today that the reason I'm alcoholic is when I pick up a drink, I have no control over how much I take or when I take it. Or when I pick up the drink, the obsession takes over and all that kind of stuff. So I do understand that. But I do know what it's like to have that kind of environment. You know, being able to walk into a bodega or the bar or whatever, you know, cop a nickel bag, 11 years old, going to the spot, you know. So I got to be careful. I get out of hand. I do a lot of where I speak is in institutions. Like I'll go into rehabs and detoxes and things like that. And that's really where I find the most identification. Or I feel like I'm of the most service because, you know, I'm wearing a shirt and tie tonight, and I've used this, not the same one, but I've stood in front of a lot of judges like this. But usually it wasn't a shirt and tie, it was usually a jumpsuit, you know, getting dragged into court, shackles, handcuffs, you know, no bail, remands. And that was kind of like my life for a long time. So sometimes I feel like instead of coming here with this, if you really want to know what I am, I should come here with a jumpsuit on, you know, like NCP on the back or something like that. And you'll probably get a little bit more of what I'm like, because I stand up here like this. But, you know, I'm the guy that slept on subways, slept on rooftops, ate out of, you know, dumpsters, soup kitchens, was in jails. My story's littered with institutions, homeless shelters, you know, all those things. And, you know, so when I picked up the first drink, it came very naturally. It felt good. It went down easy. I got drunk the first time I drank. I think I threw up the first time I drank. And I got into trouble the first time I drank. That kind of happened the whole time I drank. You know, there wasn't a lot of times where that wasn't really happening. And the problem for me is that, you know, just drinking isn't enough for me. Like, I have to mix in whatever other narcotics or anything else I can find to, you know, in addition to, you know, not in substitution for, you know what I mean? Like, I have, no matter what it is, like, I have to be completely out of my mind drunk. Or when I'm drinking, like, when I pick up a drink, if I'm not completely drunk or in the process of drinking, I just don't feel right. Because the reality of having two children that I can't take care of, and a wife that I left, and I had a job that I lost, and I got a daughter that cries because I'm not coming home. So that kind of reality, man, it isn't easy to deal with because I can't handle that. So I run from that. I drink, and I feel better. I'm kind of jumping around a bit. I'm just glad to be here, and I'm my favorite speaker, by the way. Like, you know, people say, who's your favorite? I am, you know? Like, there's no place I won't go to hear myself talk, you know? Like, I love to hear myself talk. But I also, you know, I like to listen to people, too. But I will literally, like, when I was leaving the house, I'm putting on a tie. I was saying to my girl, I'm like, oh, geez, man, I got to put on a tie. She goes, stop, man, you love that shit. I'm like, yeah, I guess I do. You know what I mean? So, you know, maybe not the tie, but whatever. So I'm here, and I'm really grateful. And by the time I was 16 years old, I was in my first rehab. The place was so nice, I went back a second time. You know what I mean? And it really was that nice because they had jacuzzis, they had saunas, they had whirlpools. I mean, I think they even had horseback riding. I mean, this place was like, and I'm from the Bronx, so going here was like, man, this is great. You know, I'm the person, I'm so institutionalized, like after all these years of being locked up in different places like that. Like, I remember walking into jails that were new and thinking, this place is pretty nice. You know, like I walk into institutions and I'm like, especially when I'm out there, I'm like, damn, this isn't that bad. So anyway, so I went into this rehab, came out, I was sober, stayed sober for about two years. Went to meetings every day. I mean, in New York, going everywhere, Manhattan, the Village, Brooklyn, no matter what, I was going to a meeting every single day. I was making coffee. I had a sponsor, it was a great guy. Just don't drink and go to meetings, man, you're doing great. So when I relapsed after about two and a half years, I went back to the rehab. I'm like, well, what happens? Like, probably stop going to meetings. I'm like, no. And when I would relapse, they'd say, you probably need to double up on your meetings. Well, if you're going to 15 a week, man, something ain't right. Like, I'm missing something here. And what I was missing was that key ingredient, that humility, that conscious contact with God. I just didn't have, wasn't able to access, or wasn't that interested in, or didn't think I needed it. Or generally what happens, to me is that problems of money, property, power, prestige divert me from my primary purpose. So that's just not for the AA group, man. That's for me as the individual. Like, I get sober, man. I get that car, I get that job, I get that girlfriend, I get that house, I get these credit cards, I get this money. Damn, everything is good. You know, on paper, I'm doing great. So those things can easily be, you know, a substitution for my higher power. Like, I feel like if I have these things, I must be doing okay. And it's so far from the truth, but I remember every time I would relapse and how bad it would get, I would go back to AA, I'd get on the, you know, back to detox. Some places I would go into the detox, you know, 2 weeks later I'm back in the same place. A lot of times, because it was so damn cold, I didn't feel like sleeping on the street. I was tired of being on the subways, you know what I mean? And I remember sleeping on the one train and the doors open, cold, they close, you go back to sleep. I mean, so this was my reality. In the winter of 94, I spent on the New York City subway system, and soup kitchens, man, rooftops, sold myself physically, mentally, spiritually to get that next drink and whatever else I might have been doing. So, I mean, I've done pretty much anything there. If there's a name, I've done it. And that was something I heard when I was doing my four step, man. If there's a name for it, someone's done it before. So, like, you know, and so it helped reduce a lot of that shame and that guilt and stuff that went with a lot of things I did when I was using. All of which, most of which, I would have not done had I not been drinking. You know, so I can take some solace in the fact that, you know, people that may have gotten injured wouldn't have if I wasn't drinking. I wouldn't have had to sell myself on a corner because I was needed to get high. You know what I'm saying? So these things that I did and how I lived were all because of alcohol. And the repercussions, like the, you know, when you throw a rock in the water, man, and there's that ripple effect. I'm like that movie, like Die Hard, or one of those things when they're going away from the explosion and he looks in the rearview mirror, man, there's buildings burning and they're falling down. And that's me. Like, I'm leaving the scene, but my family's the wreckage. You know what I mean? My job is the wreckage. You know, people's houses that have got burglarized are the wreckage. You know, stores that were robbed are the wreckage. And, you know, so that's pretty much me to a T when I drink, because drinking is just a full-time job for me. That's what I do. I'm not one of those people that drink and go out and this and that. I drink and then I just deal with nothing but like that shame of like knowing that I should not be doing this, and the reality of how bad my situation is continues for me to drink constantly. I don't know if this sounds familiar at all, but like that's how it is for me, especially when you get a head full of AA and you know you shouldn't be out there doing this. Well, the worst thing is you're drinking, you run into some idiot from AA and he's like, ah, you've been, you know, get your ass to a meeting or whatever like that. And, you know, so, but yeah, so in 1994, I went up to Albany, New York. I remember I'd gotten out of some other detox or someplace, and I'm like, well, where's the rehab? And like, dude, there's no more rehabs for you. We're sending you up to the Salvation Army. And I remember being pissed, thinking, you know, I'm too good for this place. I'm going to go to the Salvation. Meanwhile, I'm living on the streets. Anyway, I got up there. I started going to meetings. And I met a guy at a meeting. Turned out to be my uncle. And I got sober and stayed sober for over 11 years in AA. And I did everything, man. I went to meetings everywhere. I went to conferences, conventions, retreats. I mean, I was very active. I did a lot of things. And a lot of it, a lot of the stuff that I learned and the tools and stuff, I still utilize today. And like I guess the humility for me is that when I came back, I didn't need to sit around and say about all these times I had been sober before, because I just couldn't get sober again. So by putting that out there, I was separating myself from other people and from God. And for me, God is working through other people. So if I have people out here, that's where God is too. So he can't get in and fix me. So I went to meetings. I met a woman, got married, and had two kids. I remember my kids were born, I'm thinking, like, this is the best thing that's ever happened. You know, like, I got these two kids, these two amazing kids. And after my daughter was born, I was sober probably, I would say, about 11 years at that point. And I was going to a football game at Giant Stadium, and I was meeting my brother there. My brother's been sober now, like, 30-something years. But at the time, he was sober like 20 years. I'm going to the Giant Stadium. I have all this money in my pocket. I've been thinking about drinking for weeks because I'm working in an environment where after work people go out and drink. And it's looking really good to me. And I'm not understanding why. You know, all of a sudden I feel like I'm being cheated or I'm missing something. That these people are going out and drinking with impunity, man. There's no repercussions for what they're doing. And I'm thinking, well, why can't I do that? And I really just was so apart from AA. Like, I was around it. I would go to meetings, but I just wasn't present, man. I would just show up, and because I knew that I was trained that that's something I have to do, is go to meetings. But I didn't really have anything else behind it, man. There was no substance. And I'm not one of those people that meetings are a crucial part of my recovery, and they still are. And a lady was sharing the other day, and she's like, you know, when I go to a meeting, I talk to a newcomer. I get there early. I make coffee. I participate. And I had to stop and, like, really check myself, man, because sometimes I'll get on this tangent where I think the only real information, if it's not in the big book, man, I'm not trying to hear it. But so I have to be really careful with that and really careful about what I'm saying and what I'm doing, because I don't know where my help is coming from. I don't know where my higher power is coming from. I don't know how he's working in my life. So I can't close myself off to other things, you know, and things like religion and different things. You know, be quick to see where religious people are right, make use of what they offer. You know, I'm the guy that says, oh, man, the Catholic Church or this and that. And, you know, how dare me? You know, I'm the guy that, you know, runs out of a burning building, you know, and wants a pat on the back. Like, now, I've done all these things, so I need to be really careful about what I'm saying and what I'm doing in AA and standing up here. Let me get off my soapbox. But it's just important to me. Like, the fellowship's important to me. The people in it are important to me. And I know when I'm off, because it's like, damn, man, if I got to go to that meeting tonight and hear this guy one more time, man, you know, that's when I know I'm off. Like, it's an easy thing. Like, there's not, like, these big red flags that go up, or I go to my, go to work and my boss is an ass. Like, you know, like, so when I'm in that, I recognize it, which is great. But anyway, so I'm going to Giant Stadium, been sober over 11 years, wanting to drink, thinking about drinking. There'll come a time when there's absolutely no mental defense against the first drink. That defense must come from my higher power. Well, if I can't access that power and I'm sober for 11 years, where's the human power? So if I can't access that power, then I'm in real trouble. And I was that night, and I went to the game. The Giants won. Tiki Barber ran for like 220 yards. It was a great game. After it, I got on over the GW Bridge, went to the Bronx, and I was drunk in 10 minutes, and everything was gone. And that started like a run that I'm still tired from all these years later. Like, so for the next, for probably like about 7 months, I kind of maintained being like using and drinking, going to meetings, not telling anyone, being home, being miserable. And then my son, I ended up going into a rehab because I was about to lose my job. The only time I ever go into a place is because the consequences are great enough and I'm going to actually have to suffer from them. So now I'm ready to get sober. Like now I'm ready to go. But anyway, I went into rehab and people like, man, and my son was getting ready to be born on February 9th and people like, man, you're going to have a kid. Like, there's no way this guy's drinking. Like, who would drink when there's this little baby at home? Well, I'm the same guy that got drunk, went home to give that baby a bath, and damn near passed out giving him the bath. And my mother-in-law had to come in and, well, what are you doing? And I was so out of it, I had no idea that the water was scalding hot, that I was almost passed out, and I'm giving this little boy a bath. So that's kind of like what happens to me as an alcoholic. You know, if you have kids and whatever, and I mean, I drove drunk with my kids. I went and copped with my kids. I mean, like, I did whatever I had to do to drink because that was more important than anything else in my life. And that's my reality as an alcoholic. Like, I come in here desperate and dying and in need of help. And a couple of weeks go by and I'm more concerned with how my hair looks, man. Like, come on, like, I gotta get my priorities in line here. Like, I can't save my ass and my face in AA at the same time. Like, I gotta get in here and do this work and get sober and stay sober. I had, after 11 years, I had this big house, this big job. I'm making a lot of money. I have these two kids. And I picked up, and within 6 months, I lost my house, my kids, my job, my wife, my cars. I ended up in state prison in New York. And I remember when I went to jail, I got locked up for like public drunkenness. And they're like, yo, man, you got to go to court. So I went to court and I got hit with a 4-count felony indictment. And so like the reality had set right in, like, I'm not going home. Like, I'm here now. And, you know, and then I started banging on my family to get money on my books and different things like that. And that's generally what I do. I get locked up and now I'm sorry. Now I'm calling my family. Now I'm reaching out. I'm the guy that goes to jail and I start going to Bible studies and I start doing all this stuff. And I really used to think Jesus lived in jail because every time I got locked up, I found him. You know what I mean? Every time I found Jesus. And I'm ready now. I'm ready. Like, I'm getting off the tier. I'm going to Bible study. I'm going to AA. I found Jesus. I found Allah, whoever, whatever I got to do. And what always happened is when I left, Jesus was always still at the gate. Like, you know what I mean? And I come back and like, oh, there he is again. So anyway, man, it's just insane. And so from 2005, I'll try and move this along. From 2005 till about 2015, there was a 10-year stretch of an unbelievable amount of detoxes, jails, state prisons, psychiatric hospitals, homeless shelters, in and out of places. I remember one time someone said to me, Jesus, man, when do you find the time to drink? You're always in some place, you know? And, man, I'll tell you what, it was a lot. It was a lot on my family. And I remember when my daughter was 2 or 3 years old and I told her how I'm always going to protect her, you know, and I'm writing her letters from jail. I'm drawing her pictures and sending them home. And, I remember one time I got locked up and I was only in for 90 days or something. And I had called my ex-wife when I got out and I'm like, you know, I really want to see these kids. And she's like, you know, they've been waiting to see you. Why don't you come up? And while I was waiting for the bus, someone that I knew drove by that I used to cop from. And I was sober, man. Like, I was out of jail, right? I was in some frickin' treatment center in the jail. Like, one of the worst things you can ever do is be in jail and go to, like, the in-jail rehab. It's awful. Just do your time, watch TV, eat, work out, and leave. But anyway, this guy's probably been in a few places the way he's laughing. So, he's like me. Like, I have people at work, they're like, yo, man, how come you don't drink? Why don't you go out and drink with us? I'm like, all right, I'll go out and drink with you. You're going to need a bail bondsman on retainer, and I'm going to need a lawyer. So if you're ready to go, man, and, you know, you're ready to get a DUI and lose your job and all that stuff, man, let's go. And, you know, someone said to me once something a long time ago, and I still remember, it's guy Steve. He used to say, there's not one thing. He would be in a beginner's meeting. He'd say, if anyone in here can tell me one good thing alcohol ever gave you that being sober can't, I'll go out and drink with you right now. And I still remember that. And there's nothing that I can't do today sober that I did drinking. And let's face it, listening to my story, you know, the things I'm doing for fun are like robbing people's houses and, like, you know what I mean? Like drunk drive. Like I used to love drunk driving. Like, I would drink and I'd want to start driving. Like, it was a natural progression. Like, I'm one of those people that thought I drove better and whatever like that, but I used to love drinking and driving. I've had a few DUIs, you know, a couple of different states, you know. The worst one was in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. The worst place to ever get arrested is in Pennsylvania. And I remember I had been arrested in New York and New Jersey. And I was so messed up that when I got arrested and went into Northampton County Prison, I was laughing that I had just completed the Triple Crown. You know what I mean? Three different states, three different jails, you know. And so I was so warped from the alcohol, completely lost my train of thought. So talking about jail, I just go, you know, another direction with this, but... So I lost it all. I'm writing my daughter's letters from prison, and I'm promising and not delivering. You know, I'm that guy. I mean it when I say it. When I call her and say I'm going to come visit her, I mean it. Like, I'm going to do that. When I wake up in the morning and say I'm done, I'm never going to drink again, I mean it. Like, I don't believe AA's for people that wanted, or, you know, I wanted it. Like, no one wants to live like that. I wanted to be sober. I just didn't have any power. I had no choice in the matter. Like, when I stopped drinking, the obsession is so powerful that I can't think of nothing else other than, how am I going to get that next drink? Because sobriety is so uncomfortable, man. You know, being sober in AA without a program, to me, is as bad as being on the street drinking, man. It sucks, because I feel it, and everyone else around me does too. But I get out of prison, and then the last thing that happened in New York was some idiot gave me a job in an apartment complex. I can't fix anything and put a nail on a piece of wood. So he gives me a job doing maintenance in his apartment complex. And I was sober, man, and just started drinking again. So, and now I'm living in this place. Not only am I working there, but I'm living there. And an alleged burglary happens. I'm still not copping to nothing, but an alleged burglary happened, and I had to leave the state. No one was dead or pregnant, but I just knew I had to go. And before that, this is like typifies my alcoholism. I'll just kind of share this story. So I had been up for a couple of days drinking, and it was one of those ones where, like, I had, like, no matter what, I had to get another drink or another drug, whatever I was doing. And so it was Saturday, it was about 12 o'clock, 12:30, and the bank closed at 1. And now I've been up for days. I've exhausted every possibility of how I'm going to get money, but I need to drink. So I take off like in a sprint, and I run about a mile and a half to this bank that I'm planning on robbing when I get there. So I show up to the bank, like, just drenched in sweat, and the bank was just getting ready to close. So I went in, and I grabbed a deposit slip, and on the back of it, I wrote, "Give me all your money, no games." So I get up to the teller, and I slide the note through. And she looks at the note, and she's looking at me, and she looks at the note again, and she goes, "Sir, I can't read anything you wrote on here." And I was like, oh my God, I've never been more sober in my life. Like, all of a sudden, I was stone cold sober. Like, 3 days of drinking, money was wasted. I'm like, holy shit, I gotta do something here. So I said to her that, you know what, I think I have the wrong account number. I'll go out and get it. So I'm walking out and I hear, "Sir." I'm like, oh my God, "Sir." I'm like, "Oof." He goes, "I have to let you out. We locked the bank. It closes at 1 o'clock. I'm thinking to myself, I would have been on one of those TV shows, like the worst robbery ever. Like, I go into the bank and can't leave. Like, just ridiculous. So that kind of like typifies my alcoholism in kind of in a nutshell. And there's a thousand stories like that. But I tell that one because it's like, that's how insane we get, or I get, when I'm drinking and the lengths that I'll go to pick up a drink. And I don't care what's in my path. So, anyway, I came to Pennsylvania. I always say I may not be able to speak the whole time. That's usually never a problem. But anyway, I came to Pennsylvania. I started to get sober in the valley. I was going to different meetings, putting a little bit of time together. My sister's here, my sister Teresa. So I called her about 1,000 times at the emergency room, like just drunk and crying in my beer and everything like that. That's the other thing. Like, if you've been sober a while, you probably don't know what drunk texting is. So I'll tell you what it is. You get drunk and it's 2 in the morning. You start going through your phone. And years ago, you would call someone and they wouldn't answer. But I would send things to people and then have evidence of what I sent the next day. And I was like, oh my God, I cannot believe I texted her that or him that or whatever. But so anyway, my bottom, you know, the last time I drank wasn't really any different than, it wasn't worse than the other times. You know, it certainly wasn't worse than when I got arrested or when I got beat up or whatever like that. But, you know, I was getting to the point where, I couldn't function alcoholically anymore. Like, I couldn't drink. I didn't know if one drink was going to get me bombed or if I had to drink you know what I mean? Like, no amount of alcohol could ease what was happening for me. And I had a job. I sell cars for a living. And I would go to work drunk. And I couldn't drink at home. So my girlfriend, by now, is, like, watching everything I do. And so I would go to work to drink. Like, I didn't come home from work and drink. I woke up and went to work to drink. So, and I would go on test drives with people completely drunk, like an out of my mind drunk, like not a little bit, just slurring my words, intoxicated. And I had this one old lady who was definitely afraid to drive. She's like, "Would you drive the car for me?" And I'm like, "I'm all over the road, man. I'm all over the road." And she's like, "Oh wow, this car handles great." But what happened to me was I got arrested for a DUI, and I did a little bit of time, went to work release, came out, had the ankle bracelet, and this was the end of my drinking. I had the ankle bracelet on, and I was at work, and I was high and drunk, and I thought it would be a good idea to go to, I got to be careful with narcotics here, but to the alcohol spot to get some money, right? So I get in the car, and I'm driving on 22, and I pull a U-turn in the middle of 22 and get pulled over. So I have no license or no license on me. I'm drunk, and I have an ankle bracelet on, and I have multiple DUIs and arrests on my record. I'm sitting there, I'm like, man, I'm in big trouble. So the cop comes up, and he's like, "Sir, can I see your license?" And I'm like, "I don't have it with me." So I gave him my brother's name, and the only reason I remember, because my brother's birthday is Christmas Day, so I always remember his birthday. So I'm like, "I'm Robert Cleary, when's your birthday?" I told him. So the cop's probably thinking, who in their right mind would, you know, so like if he'd got, he would, I've been out of the car and arrested. So it's 2 in the afternoon. And he lets me go. He gives me like 5 tickets though, like no license, careless driving, illegal U-turn, all kinds of stuff. So I keep going to the spot, keep drinking. And the next day I'm like, man, this is bad. This is really bad. And I knew that I had to do something. And my girlfriend would take me to meetings, and she took me to the Nazareth group one night. And I went out and I watched her leave, and I went to the bar and started drinking. And I got home and she's like, how is it possible that I brought you to a meeting and now you're completely intoxicated? So the next week she brought me to that meeting again, and she was sitting on the stairs outside, and someone is here, Jimmy actually, you know, he said to her, like, you know, there's nothing you can do for him. Like, we have to help him, basically. And those are things I remember because she remembers it. And she talks about it. She still gets tears in her eyes because she was completely powerless, man. She was more powerless over my alcoholism than I was. And she was suffering more than I was. My kids were suffering more than I was. And I just would run from responsibility, man, because I just couldn't handle it. So anyway, what ended up happening was, again, I'm going to lose everything. I called my brother. I'm like, you know, Rob, I got to tell you something. He's like, what? Like, well, I got a ticket. He goes, all right. I was like, and I gave him your name. He's like, all right. I'm like, well, there's 5 of them. So he's like, man, you got to figure this out. So anyway, I knew that if I went to rehab that I could get a letter for whoever. I hired a lawyer. He told me what to do. I went to rehab, came out. That got sorted out, and I stressed about it a lot. I prayed about it a lot. And then I'm getting taken care of. Through a series of bunch of different events, the charges were not thrown out, but they didn't become something that would include me going to jail. And again, that's really the reason I say that, because I was sober now, and this lady that I worked with that always seen me drunk, she was like, wow, man, you're completely different. And her husband was a lieutenant or something in the Phillipsburg Police Department. Phillipsburg has like 5 or 6 liquor stores. I know where every one of them are. Phillipsburg has a ton of police too, like a ton. But anyway, so I went to rehab. And when I got to the rehab that night, I said a prayer and I asked God to help me. Because I couldn't stop drinking. I was completely powerless. And the obsession was so powerful that the thought of being sober scared me. And I woke up the next day and a couple of days went by. And I hadn't thought about drinking. And it was like, it was literally a miracle to me that it was this problem, this obsession that was so powerful that I had no control over. No human power could solve. AA groups couldn't solve it. My sponsor couldn't solve it. My family couldn't solve it. God removed and did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And that's God's grace, man. And grace is an unwarranted gift. I didn't deserve that gift. Everything in my life said I didn't deserve it. But he removed that from me, and it opened all the doors. And I was able to come back to AA and humbly ask people to help me, get a sponsor, get a home group, work the steps. And my sponsor was like, come on, man, now we're going to get sober. You're going to get out the pen and third step prayer, boom, make your resentment list and let's go. And so I went through the steps with him. And I was like, I was willing to do anything at all to stay sober. And amazingly, that stayed with me. Because that has a short shelf life, man. Like, I'm usually willing to do anything until, all right, make coffee or go here or do this or do that. Like, it wears off quick. And I've accumulated things again, but they're not my higher power anymore. Like, they're just not. Like, I talked to my daughter today. She's 16 years old now. She tells me about her friends, you know, social media stuff, like some stuff I don't even want to hear about. But she relies on me, man. And when I say I'm going to be there, I'm there for her. Like, I was able to make amends to those kids and look them in the eye. And they know that I'm here. Like, they hear my voice. They see it in my face. They can smell it on me. You can, when someone's sober, like, and they're lit up, man, you know it. Like, people in this room, when you see them, you're like, oh, my God. I can't believe that guy's sober, or you see the strength that some meetings have and the power and that feeling that underlies everything is God. And so I'm in their lives today and the person they need me to be. I'm working, I'm still at that same job. You know, I'm almost off. Probably get 5 years probation. I'm on probation now until I think I got 4 or 5 months left. And now I email the guy thinking, where was this years ago? Like, I was getting urine tests and after urine tests. I don't know if anyone knows what SASE is, where you got to call every week, you know, call every day. When you're an active addict and you're using, like, I did everything. I would drink gallons of water, you know, all these things. And one day I had been drinking all night and doing whatever else. And my color came up, and I knew that I was going to piss dirty, and so I called in a bomb scare to Northampton County, and they evacuated the building. And to me, it made perfect sense, because I had run out of anything left to do. So I called in the bomb scare, and I didn't have to go in and give urine that day. 2 weeks later, I did, so I went to the emergency room and told them I was going to kill myself. So I had a medical excuse for why I couldn't take it. You know, so these are the things that I did, you know, and did, and eventually I got locked up for that too. But anyway, so I don't know where I was going with that. Get off track easy here. But I'm not living like that is the bottom line. I'm almost off probation, and I'm a little resentful because I love going into institutions, and I was finally able to go into the Lehigh County Jail and speak. So I got cleared to go in. I went in and spoke and told the story, told a little bit about the, you know, the probation stuff. And the next day I got this email from Jim that was running. I was going to start doing this like once a month going in there. And I'm so excited because I love to do that stuff. And I like, he's like, Tom, man, this is awful, but you've been denied entry into the jail. And now I'm pissed, man. I'm like, you know how many times I got arrested and I was only allowed entry into the jail? Like, now I want to go in, and they're saying no. And I'm like thinking, well, you know what, if I burn that bitch down, then I can get in there. Like, I'm my sick thinking, you know. I do a lot of things now today. I'm really involved in AA. I love the steps. I love the big book. I do the big book workshop. And, you know, I've gone through the steps a couple of times like that. And I'm not one of those people that get caught up on, should I do a 4-step again, or am I always doing a 10-step? And I really believe after a while the numbers fall off the steps. Like, they just come naturally to me, or they work in my life, and I don't even really know that I'm doing it. So, like, at night when I, not every night, but when I do the reviews and stuff like that, whether it's in the book as a 10th or the 11th step, doesn't make a difference. The idea is that I'm doing it, and I'm trying to live these principles on a daily basis. So if I'm confusing a page or a paragraph, man, I really don't think it makes a difference. A couple of things I really like in here is, you know, the doctor's opinion and the, you know, Bill's story, there is a solution, and more about alcoholism. Like, all of that up to page 43, it says, and once more, you know, the alcoholic has no mental defense against the first drinker. We hope you showed you what the real alcoholic is. So it takes all of these pages, and then it says, and once more. And that's not once more, because the next page in We Agnostics, it's again, you know, says exactly what it is. And I just wanted to kind of read it, because I think it's funny that at the end of page 43, it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. I don't know any of those yet. Neither here nor any human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So that's at the end of 43. And then you think and it's done, and then it says, in the preceding chapter, we have learned something about alcoholism. And then it tells us one more time, in just case we didn't get it again, that's how thick-headed we are, that if you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And I really believe my spiritual experience and my spiritual awakening is, you know, getting up in the morning and just, or driving somewhere and just being like, damn, man, I can't believe I'm doing this. And, you know, being available to God, keeping myself open to God, having a conscious contact, as I go throughout the day, I pause when I'm agitated or doubtful. I ask for the right thought or action. I constantly remind myself I'm no longer running the show. I humbly ask God, what can I do? Where can I help? And usually those things are revealed and I'm shown the way. And that for me is really where my strength come from. And I don't do it perfectly, man. I make so many mistakes. Sometimes I feel like I've made more mistakes sober than I ever did drunk. You know, but I'd rather err on trying to do the right thing and make a mistake than just avoiding and one thing that trips me up a lot is defiance. Like if I get up in the morning, I don't pray every morning, I don't meditate every morning. Sometimes I run out of the house late. But if there's that day that I get up and I'm like, maybe I should say a prayer, and then I'm like, nah man, I gotta get going. That's when I stop and I say the prayer, because that defiance, man, that separation from that not needing anymore is really critical for someone like me that has been coming to AA for over 30 years, been sober for 20 of them, still pissed that there's no coin for 20 out of 30, because I don't think that's that bad, you know. But I'm here and I'm really grateful, you know, and I'm grateful that I can pick up a phone and call my kids and they know where I am. And just real quickly, I know we're almost done here, but a couple of amends that I made. I went up to see my kids and my ex-wife and mother-in-law. There's also 1,000 businesses I robbed up there, but I'm not ready to make amends to them yet. So I feel like giving them the money is really what it is. But, and I'm waiting for the person to say, just donate a little bit of money to charity. Don't worry about it. It's not how it works. At least it's not going to work for me, so... They're on that eventually I'm going to get to them, amends thing. I just feel like if I can't walk in with 10 grand, why give them 100? You know what I mean? So I go up to make amends to the ex-wife and the kids, and I talk to my kids. And my ex-wife, one time I tried to make amends to her, and she's like, just write a letter. And I'm thinking, I'm not putting nothing on paper, like nothing, just in case, right? But anyway, so some time has gone by, and I go outside and we talk, and you know, I listen to what, you know, I did and whatever like that. And she goes, you know what, man, your kids are your, you know, they're your biggest fans. You know, and I see you with them and I know you're sober. And now I have to make amends to my ex-mother-in-law too. And I'm like, you know, Gail, Jesus, you know, I know the time with Aiden and the tub and blah, blah, blah. And I wasn't a good husband to Tammy, you know. She goes, you know what, she wasn't a good wife either. Wow, man. So I really felt like, now did I really need to make that amends to my ex-wife? You know, like maybe she really was that bad. You know, maybe I wasn't that awful, you know. One thing that's really funny that happened recently, this guy that I sponsor, and you know how weed is legal in Colorado and Washington or wherever like that. So he's saying to me that if he goes to Washington, is he allowed to smoke weed? And I'm thinking, what's this guy talking about? First of all, he doesn't have a license. He couldn't buy a plane ticket, you know, if you fronted them three quarters of it. I mean, but anyway, so I'm like, come on, man. I'm like, really, you know, whether it's legal or illegal, whatever, you can't smoke weed. But what's really funny is that I'm driving home and I'm thinking, I wonder if I was in Washington if I could smoke weed. Like the thinking is so warped, you know, and I'm ready to call my sponsor and ask him, what does he think, you know? But so I'm vigilant. I do what I need to do on a daily basis, and I'm really grateful that you guys had me down here, and my sister asking me to come down and speak to, and Lauren, she's not here, but this is awesome, man. This is like the field of dreams out here, so thanks for letting me share.